If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
If you're looking for the perfect Christmas gift, why not take out a subscription to BBC History Magazine for just £34.99? That's a saving of over 50% on the shop price. A subscription is a present that can be enjoyed all year round, and every issue will be delivered direct to their door. To take advantage of this fantastic offer, visit our official online store at buysubscriptions.com/history2020. If you're based in the US or Canada, you can subscribe for just $55. To find out more and for all other countries, head to buysubscriptions.com/history2020.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. The Reformation of the 16th century is one of the defining events in Christian history, but it also had a profound effect on the lives of Europe's Jews and their relations with their Christian neighbours. This is the subject explored by the historian Kenneth Austin of the University of Bristol in his new book, The Jews and the Reformation. And he spoke to BBC History Magazine editor Rob Attar.
Kenneth, considering that the Reformation was essentially an internal Christian event, why do you feel that it's very important to consider the Jewish dimension?
That's a good question. I suppose there's two main reasons. I mean, I think the first thing is that actually the Jewish presence in Europe is significant. You're right, or they're a relatively small group, but they still constitute maybe something like 1% of the population. So they are a substantial religious minority within that Christian context. But I think equally, thinking about Jewish presence in Europe in the Reformation also then tells us quite a lot about what mattered to the Christian majority as well. So thinking about how Christians look towards Jews of the Bible, Jewish language and culture, the relationship between Judaism and Christianity, all of these things, allow us to understand better what is going on in the minds of the Christians during the Reformation era.
And so prior to the Reformation, how would you describe relations between the Christian and Jewish communities in Europe?
ambivalent at the very least. I think on the one hand, there is an enthusiasm, a positive dimension towards Jews at various places. It explains why Jews are invited into large parts of the continent, gradually through the Middle Ages, going from the southern fringes of Europe, invited into northern Europe, invited in by political leaders, often who see in the Jews an opportunity to modernize their economies. Famously, maybe stereotypically, Jews often hold the role of moneylenders in society, but act as tax collectors as well. And those roles that they pursue allow economies in Europe to develop. And especially in the early stages, and when those Christian societies are seeing relatively small numbers of Jews, it's quite straightforward to have the Jews there. As their numbers grow, there becomes maybe slightly greater tensions. But those only really start to become apparent in the 13th century. And indeed, I think sort of one of the things I probably try and say about the medieval period is the extent to which actually good relations are more the norm. I think sort of the historical record, and certainly the impression that one has, is of constant conflict, animosity, and so on. But actually, through most of the period and in most communities, relations are relatively harmonious. It's difficult because there are certainly a range of accusations that are made against Jews in the Middle Ages, that they try and kill individual Christian children, for instance, that they try and cause harm to the host, the bread that's used in the mass, and so on. And these stories do spread through the Middle Ages and generate great anxiety on the part of Christian communities at times. But those still seem to be relatively isolated episodes. They generate a lot of attention in that sort of particular time period.
And where there is anti-Semitism in this period, how similar is that to the anti-Semitism of today, or are there clear differences?
I think I prefer, in certainly talking about this period, to use the term anti-Judaism. I think anti-Semitism has kind of racial overtones and very much a product of the 19th century discourse around Jews, and kind of gives almost a pseudoscientific justification to treating the Jews as other. I think in the period that I'm dealing with, in the late Middle Ages and into the Reformation era, Jews are, yes, they are kind of seen as different, but it's fundamentally a religious difference that they are understood to be, and so it is about the relationship between those communities understood in those terms and that's the reason I think sort of why anti-Judaism that perhaps does have a more theological dimension at its core. So I think part of the tension in the relations between Jews and Christians is actually because they have so much in common. That kind of, they are part of that Judeo-Christian tradition, as we now call it. They both have the Old Testament in common, but they have gone in sort of different ways thereafter. But actually their theologies have much in common. They're sharing that same text. It's then whether or not Jesus was the Messiah, and whether the New Testament or the Talmud, as the Jewish equivalent or the Jewish successor to the Old Testament, carries greater weight.
Now, Martin Luther was, I think it's fairly well known, he harboured anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish beliefs. How much did that feed into his actions during the Reformation?
It kind of seems that it drives, it is one of the driving forces for him. And actually it leads to quite positive aspects early on, or relatively speaking, at least. I think there's his late writings on the Jews are the ones that are most famous, most offensive. Early on in his career, I mean, remarkably early, in fact, if one thinks he pins the 95 Theses to the cathedral church in 1517, he writes that Jesus Christ was born a Jew in 1523, so only 6 years later. And part of that, I think, is a sense in that he's trying to say that Catholic approaches to Jews have been unnecessarily harsh, that they've not given a good example of Christianity, that actually his reformed version, that is a simplified, more pious version of Christianity, is better, and indeed, I think, sort of harbors the hope that the proof of that will be demonstrated by the fact that many Jews will then convert to Christianity of a sort that he puts forward. And I think sort of, I mean, it's an underlying sort of facet of Christian thought, but Reformation thought more broadly about what role the Jews will have in the history of the world, and especially divine history, and especially the idea that at the end times, Jews will convert to Christianity. That is the long-term expectation. And in the Reformation era, and for people like Martin Luther especially, there is a belief for a range of reasons that they are living in those end times, that the signs are all around them, that sort of the end of the world is coming. The advance of the Ottoman Turks to the east, their capture of Constantinople in 1453, at least as Luther suggests, that the papacy is now home to the Antichrist, the sort of this real attack on the center of Catholicism. This is Christianity as he sees it, sort of Christianity in a process of collapse almost, but that's the context in which his new or restored version of Christianity, a purified version, can take place. And there is an expectation that great transition will lead into the last days, possibly quite rapidly. One of the things that really drives Luther through much of his career is a real sense of urgency. And one sees it in some aspects of the Radical Reformation as well, that this is sort of, actually, we need to reform society. We need to make all these changes immediately, because the end of the world is coming, and we can't be caught napping. This needs to happen immediately. And it really drives, I think, for Lutherans and some others to write prolifically, to deliver endless sermons, to work themselves as many hours as they can possibly muster, simply because this is really critical. For Luther, I think after that initial optimism and sort of this message that if we present Christianity in a more accessible and engaging way, and we put forward a message that doesn't just treat the Jews as an enemy, they may then be more ready to come to us. That initial optimism rapidly falls away. There are maybe some interests demonstrated by Jews in his writings, but perhaps that interest tends to be rather more in a sort of an awareness of disruption within the Christian majority, rather than necessarily thinking, right, we actually see enough there to think about converting. And I think that disappointment and his disappointment for Luther, both with the Jews' failure to convert in anything like the numbers that he hoped, but also with the failure of the Reformation movement to make the advances that he hoped it would, lead to a wide range of vitriolic, unpleasant writings in the last years of his life. He dies in 1546, but for the last maybe 8 years at least, he's writing against a whole range of enemies, as he sees it, of his Christian message. All these people that have essentially sabotaged what he was trying to do, and the Jews are certainly identified as one of those groups. They have failed to acknowledge the Christian message, the Christian message that ultimately he thinks is self-evident. The New Testament, for Luther and for many Christians, the New Testament provides sufficient proof that Jesus is the Messiah. For Jews to reject that is baffling to him, and demonstrates either ignorance on their part or stubbornness, a refusal to accept that. Of course, they see things very differently, but that's his mind, his mindset, his worldview, and that of many Christians in that time, that to reject that kind of message is it almost inexplicable. This very much builds on a medieval mindset in many ways. They're one of the most famous decorations that sort of one can see on the outside of a number of churches dating from the Middle Ages is a pair of statues, Ecclesia and Synagoga, representing the Christian church and the synagogue, or therefore Christianity and Judaism. And they are both elegant women, but the character Synagoga typically is presented with a blindfold, and holding perhaps tablets reflecting sort of the biblical message and particularly the commandments of the Old Testament. But that is meant to reflect the idea that Judaism is blind to the Christian message. And even when it's done in that relatively sympathetic, it's still a beautiful woman that is presented in those statues. That's the underlying accusation against Jews, their failure to accept what might be seen by Christians as self-evident.
And then do we see evidence of the emerging Protestant communities having different relations with their Jewish neighbours or treating them differently from the existing Catholic ones?
I think there definitely is a difference. I mean, I suppose, and certainly in my book, I suppose for at least for reasons of clarity and organization, I tend to sort of work by different Christian confessions, that is, the different groups in turn. So looking at Lutherans, Calvinists, Anabaptists, Catholics, and in some ways, that's to kind of, because each has its own narrative, its own story. I suppose one of the things that I want still to say within that framework is that actually to talk about a standard Lutheran view or a standard Calvinist view or a standard Catholic view ends up being sort of perhaps a little bit too neat. And the reality is that even within the Lutheran context, some of Luther's collaborators reject what he has to say when in his later career. They're much less inclined to endorse, particularly when he's sort of saying blaming the Jews for failing to welcome the Christian message and recommending therefore very harsh treatment of Jews in Christian territories, that their houses should be smashed, their synagogues broken down, they should be subjected to hard labor and menial tasks, and so on. A number of his, even his Lutheran collaborators say, hang on, no, that's going way too far. Yes, sort of we want to bring them to understand a Christian message, but there are other ways of doing that. And that may be more through persuasion and discussion and so on. And so I think it's important to say that sort of there is that kind of positive dimension within Lutheranism. One can perhaps see it more repeatedly, however, within the Reformed tradition, and that kind of perhaps a greater readiness to work with Jews and to incorporate Jewish scholarship in their own research, their own biblical exegesis, especially, and to draw on rabbinic lines of interpretation and argument. And it certainly is the case that someone like John Calvin, for instance, does rather more explicitly draw on Jewish lines of interpretation, particularly in relation to the Psalms, but that this is sort of filtered into his biblical writings more generally. And I think, again, a number of his collaborators within that broader Reformed tradition similarly have rather more nuanced and at times sympathetic attitudes, either working, as I say, with Jews or more commonly Jewish converts, but a greater readiness still to engage with Jewish traditions of thought.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
That vulnerability to attack is one of the almost the defining characteristics of the Jewish experience in the 16th and 17th century, that while they may be there and tolerated by the rulers, by the local communities, it can all change in an instant.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
And I suppose the Reformation meant that there was a lot more plurality within Christianity. You had lots more religious pluralism, different confessions. So did that in a way make it easier for Jewish communities in that they were one of many minorities rather than the main religious minority?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think again, and I mean, one of the broader contextual factors is, I think I said towards the outset, that Jews in roughly 1500, constitute perhaps 1% or of the European population. But they're not evenly spread. They had been expelled from England and France during the Middle Ages, and in the late 15th century, perhaps most famously, they're expelled from Spain by Ferdinand and Isabella as well. And in those places that they find a more sympathetic home, places like Italy and the Holy Roman Empire, for instance, they're not, again, universally sort of spread or spread evenly across those terrains. They may be found in some, both those polities are broken up into many different parts, neither are unified territories in this period. So it does mean that you might find Jews congregating in some areas and then no Jews whatsoever, or virtually no Jews in adjoining territories. And that does make it easier for the Jews within reason that they can move between those territories, which wasn't possible in a place like Spain, England, or France, which have that kind of more centralized organization. It does, I suppose, in sort of thinking about the difference between the Lutheran and Calvinist traditions, mean that Jews are more part of Luther's day-to-day world than they are Calvin's. And it's certainly possible. I mean, it's difficult to prove conclusively, but it's certainly the case that Luther is in Germany going to many places when he's going and delivering sermons and traveling and so on, that he's actually encountering Jews on a regular basis. For Calvin in France, from where Jews had been expelled, and then Geneva, from where they'd been expelled more recently, he's not got this day-to-day encounter with Jews. And that's, I suppose that's true for a lot of Christians during this period. And sort of for some of those, the Jews become a kind of an abstract enemy. I think it is one of the real paradoxes of this, that the strongest or most famous anti-Jewish kind of messaging, certainly in an English context, comes from something like Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice or Christopher Marlowe's Jew of Malta. And in England, Jews had been expelled in 1290, and they're writing in sort of around 1600, so 300 years later, a country in which Jews had not at least had any official presence there for so long. But Jews did, in that kind of imaginary, provided a focal point for certain Christian anxieties. But that's harder to sustain in the longer term. And actually, again, as your question suggested, in that era of religious pluralism, when Christians, having gone from Christianity, a single entity, give or take, in 1500 to a point maybe by the later 16th century when it is Christianity has fragmented into still Catholicism, though with some kinds of divisions within it, and then Protestantism fragmenting sort of left, right, and centre, Lutherans, and we use these kind of these terms to still impose coherence on it, that the Lutherans break into different trends, the Reformed tradition, Calvinism, the Zurich tradition, others, the Anabaptists, a group that they wouldn't recognize, but sort of a whole range of maybe 15, 20 different radical groups, Puritans later, Quakers, all of these different groups. And actually, in many territories, it is that rivalry between Catholic and Protestant, or between Lutheran and Calvinist, that actually is the more immediate threat to to the piety of your community. I think in this period, I suppose it's one of the things about thinking about how religion actually matters in this context. Some of it's theology. Some of it is about what does a person like Luther or Calvin actually say, and their equivalents. But actually quite a bit of it is, what is it to be a member of a pious community? What is it to be a good Christian? What is it to have a good Christian society? And one of the issues that such societies then have to work is, how do we deal with religious difference? How do we deal with people that don't fit in? And that might be Jews or Muslims or indeed converts from Judaism and Islam. But increasingly in this period of pluralism that the Reformation instigates, it can be other Christians as well. And they are as perceived as much a threat to the sanctity, to the piety of a Christian community, because they're while they're Christians, they're doing their Christianity wrong. And I think sort of they are kind of, because they are typically in greater numbers, they are a military threat as well as a political, a social, and a cultural threat. Those religious divisions do then mean that the Jews become one of several religious others, not necessarily the most pressing, the most threatening at any given moment.
And then a lot of these threats ultimately spill out into military conflict, things like the 30 Years' War. Obviously, there's a civil war here in Britain. How do these affect the Jewish communities? Do they get caught up in the violence?
They absolutely do, and in different ways. I mean, I suppose on the one hand, because they are often in communities, in societies, with the special permission of the rulers, or they are given particular privileges to be there. And in times of war, rulers will then look to tax their Jewish inhabitants, or to impose other levies and costs upon them because of those straitened circumstances. So we need greater resource. We're going to tax everyone, but the Jews will be subject to that even more. And that is especially the case during the 30 Years' War. But it's also the case that the nature of warfare does mean that a lot of communities, whether Christian or Jewish, are caught up in those conflicts. That a marauding army has to find somewhere to stay, or it makes an attack on a city. And I think, sort of again, the Jews of many cities, whether or not they are gathered together in a ghetto so named, are still clustered often together in adjoining streets. They are frequently identified, often wrongly, but frequently identified as being among the wealthier inhabitants. So if you've got a marauding army, or you've got a community that has been subject to the deprivations that 20, 30 years of warfare brings, then the tensions rise and the readiness of the Christian communities to look around, who looks like they're doing better than us? And if there is sort of the kind of an anti-Jewish sentiment that is sort of perhaps been part of the inherited tradition. This may not have had any recent cause, but is part of something that has been discussed over the generations, then suddenly can spark back into life again. It can be given renewed vigor in those circumstances. And that can then often act as a sort of the provocation to go and ransack the Jewish community. And I think that sort of that vulnerability to attack is one of the almost the defining characteristics of the Jewish experience in the 16th and 17th century. That while they may be there and tolerated by the rulers, by the local communities, it can all change in an instant, and often without them actually having done anything to provoke that. But suddenly the circumstances can change, and either the Christian authorities or the local population will move against them. And sometimes, it's clear that the political leaders in particular will use them effectively as a pressure valve. You've got a population that is increasingly upset about how things are working in that society, and then the leader, who may have invited the Jews in, may well have long-term working relationships with his Jewish community, actually realizes, for political expedience, if I now attack the Jews, expel them, or subject them to some extra layer of persecution, that may hopefully calm the rest of the population down. Equally, the population as a whole may similarly turn against the Jews again, as with sometimes on quite a slight provocation. And so that vulnerability, I think, sort of really does define or characterize the Jewish experience through so much of this. And it's only exacerbated in times of war.
Now, I appreciate that it might be hard to generalize, but do we have a sense of how the Jewish communities themselves felt about the Reformation and the changes going on in the Christian communities around them?
I suppose, I mean, in my book, and I've looked much more at the Christian perspective on this. I think, sort of, I mean, one of the things that it's often suggested that sort of the Reformation almost entirely passes the Jewish communities by in some respects. I think, sort of, you know, they go from being assaulted or subjected to the various things that I've talked about, from one big Catholic Christian community to a series of different Protestant and Catholic communities, and their sort of their day-to-day experiences aren't necessarily very different. But I think there is perhaps more to say there. I think, as I alluded to earlier, there is a little bit. There's real enthusiasm when the Reformation first comes on the scene, when Luther begins his challenge against the Catholic Church, and there's a lot of Jewish reports alluding to Luther seeing him as some kind of savior, somebody that is putting forward a message that is more sympathetic to them. So it's clear that a number of members of different Jewish communities are reading both some of Luther's writings and certainly are well informed about what he is saying. As I suggested, there may be more a case of seeing that this could be good news because it looks like Christianity is self-destructing, and sort of this may mean that our fortunes as Jews are enhanced. But I think sort of after that, then there's a sort of it maybe sort of shifts more to pragmatism and working out what is actually a viable means of working with the Christian majority in those societies where they are allowed to be there. So again, in maybe a place like Spain, we're maybe talking more about converts, conversos, as they're often known. But in Protestant Germany, Catholic Italy, it's ways of finding how to exist in a Christian, predominantly Christian society. So some of that then means self-control and self-restraint. And I think that's one of the really striking things, is the way that, again, for the reasons of vulnerability that I was talking about before, the Jewish leadership actually will often exert considerable control over its members. They are aware of how easily Christians might turn against them. So there's a conscious policy of not doing anything that might antagonize. So that might be saying, you know, at Easter, for instance, Christians will go out and do these celebrations. We're all going to stay indoors. So sometimes that can be sort of the Christian authorities will say, you must. But actually, sometimes the Jews will almost impose that on their members and say, we know how they react if we're seen out, and that anything we do, they'll take offense at. So let's just avoid that problem. Let's stay indoors on those critical days. And again, this becomes apparent in the Netherlands, especially in places like Amsterdam. While they may be allowed a place to worship, they will keep it very low key. It will just be a synagogue that takes place in somebody's home. So it is known by the Christian inhabitants that that's what is happening. But at the same time, it is not a synagogue being placed in the center of the city and kind of giving that physical face to the Jewish presence. So there's kind of moderation there. Similarly, in terms of censorship, and one sees this especially in Catholic countries, that Jewish communities, when they're publishing books in Hebrew will actually liaise with the Inquisition, will liaise with the Catholic authorities before publishing a book. And sort of this is so that they don't fall foul of censorship after the matter, and sort of say, we know what you don't like, and we'll miss this out, or we'll be very careful, especially in terms of publishing the Talmud, and that's the most provocative. That's the kind of Jewish immediately sort of post Old Testament learning and reflections and so on. That is most provocative or sort of difficult for Christian authorities to accept. But for many other Jewish writings, there's an awareness and a readiness to sort of say, we'll make sure that nothing controversial is published. We'll look after this. And I think sort of that it's that kind of level of pragmatism and expediency that actually allows, in many instances, good relations. And that is often, you know, that sort of Jews restricting what they do. So this is, it's absolutely not a meeting of equals here, but it's a way of taking control and trying to mitigate some of the tensions that might otherwise arise.
Now, by the time that the Reformation comes to an end, and I realise there's a lot of debate about when that is, but would you say that Judeo-Christian relations were better than before it started, were worse, or were still similar?
I mean, that's in some ways that's the million-dollar question that I'm trying to wrestle with in the book. I think, and I suppose, I mean, the grand narrative across the book, or at least the broad phases, certainly leads one to that kind of general pattern. So, starting out in sort of around the period of 1500 is the and further wave of expulsions of Jews. So in 1500 there are fewer Jews in Western Europe than at any time over the previous 1,000 years, and through the 16th century, there is then sort of actually probably heightened tensions between the two as Christians become ever more concerned about the sanctity, the piety of the world around them, and Jews become one of the obvious pressure points and often sort of victims of that. But things, in a sense, sort of even out, and there becomes a more nuanced and sophisticated and complex response to a Jewish presence and Jewish learning through that period. And by the 17th century, Jews are then starting to be integrated more widely and welcomed back into places in Western Europe. So spreading across various parts of Germany, into the Netherlands, and then in the 1650s, readmitted back into to England. And I think that kind of... There are multiple explanations, and sort of whether that's all down to the Reformation is probably sort of would be to overstate my case. But I think sort of my underlying belief is that the Reformation certainly helps prepare the way for some of that shift. At the same time, that's not to say everything is now perfect for the Jews, even in many of those places where they are readmitted, and I think England is a good example of that. They are readmitted, at least in part, and the sort of the theological arguments around this, on the assumption that this will facilitate their ultimate conversion to Christianity. So this isn't, I mean, it's a sort of a broader theme that what we actually understand by toleration in this period. And certainly the Puritans in particular, who make the argument we should let Jews into England for religious reasons, sometimes are described as philo-Semitic or that sort of that attitude as philo-Semitism. Again, for the reasons that we talked about before, the Semitism bit of this is not an ideal term, but that philo, or kind of suggesting that this is a positive attitude towards Jews It's certainly positive compared with maybe Luther's statements, for instance, but it's not yet an acceptance of Jews on their own terms. It's not just saying, we want to let Jews come into England and live and worship as they choose. The argument is being made on the grounds that, again, that this is part of their conversion to Christianity, is part of that those last days, the end of the world, I think sort of now that as they believe Jews are to be found in all corners of the world, that this is a sort of except England, it's then almost embarrassing, especially for the English. How can England be the home of the new world that will emerge, as the many of the English hope, if we don't actually have any Jews who will convert? So I think there's sort of, they are, by the end of the 17th century, Jews are in many more places than they were before, and they have perhaps a better experience than was the case at 1500. But there were many limitations on that. And actually, I mean, again, there's almost a sort of a paradox within that. It is in those places where Jews are given greatest liberties, and this is true through the 16th and 17th century, where they are allowed greatest freedom, that often the strongest reaction against that will emerge. That this again becomes a contentious point, and sort of in the Whitehall Conference in the 1650s, when there is discussion whether Jews should be readmitted to England, there are very strong arguments put forward on both sides, on both religious and economic grounds, and sort of great anxieties. And it is certainly the case that sort of by the 18th century again, pressures are renewed against the Jews, and efforts to really restrict what Jews can do in England and elsewhere. So it's not, I think sort of by 1700, things are better. Some of that is because of what the Reformation was doing. Some of it is almost despite what the Reformation was doing. And sort of above all, however, it's still an ambivalent situation. It is still one where there is, even where the gains have been made, there are still obstacles. There is still the chance of local animosity. There is still the chance of being subject to pressures and so on at any moment.
So I know this is outside the scope of your book, but to what extent does the Reformation influence Judeo-Christian relations in subsequent centuries?
I think one of the things that the Reformation does, and it does this from both the Protestant and Catholic sides, and I think sort of through this book, I do talk about reformations, or that implied range of reform movements, Catholic and Protestant. They give new attention to Judaism and Jews, both contemporary and in the Old Testament, and they sharpen the tensions between Christian communities. So they provide a new way, I think, of the different confessions competing with each other. So whether that is in terms of biblical scholarship, understanding Jews and their experiences and so on. So one of the things that not only are Christians thinking about, how do they make the case that their religion or their version of Christianity is the superior one? Part of the argument that they make there is that it's the most authentic, it is the one that is closest to, or that best echoes the message that they found in the Bible, and the Bible therefore needs to be understood. In order to understand some of the cultural resonances, this isn't just a linguistic activity, but to understand the cultural resonances, they need to better understand the Jews that live amongst them. So a whole slew of texts are written, sometimes described as ethnographies, a kind of early form of social anthropology. And that might mean that the author goes and spends time in a synagogue or living with Jewish families to understand what they believe, how they practice, in the hope that this will then help them understand when we read this in the Old Testament or indeed the New Testament, this is what Jesus or whoever was doing, what were they actually thinking, and that kind of, that understanding. And I think that that kind of greater engagement that the Reformation provokes, both on the Protestant side but replicated on the Catholic side, I think that does have a longer term legacy, that there is a case of thinking about again the long-term relationship between Judaism and Christianity over sort of hundreds, thousands of years, and thinking about, I think there is an appreciation of that tension. Yes, these are sort of linked together in that Judeo-Christian tradition. The Christians are trying to distinguish themselves from the Jews, but at the same time finding numerous echoes. And actually, I think sort of perhaps the strongest positive legacy from the Reformation is that effort to really come to better understand the Jews that live in their midst. I think sort of part of the problem, especially sort of in that era of expulsions, is that the Jews go from being a neighbor to an imagined entity. And in that sort of realm, it is much easier for the most alarming stories to sound a bit more plausible. Actually, once Jews are readmitted and their religion is better understood, Christians start to realize some of the things that, at least, that we have said about Jews are palpably false. This simply cannot be true. And I think sort of that longer-term legacy, at least, is a positive one, even if it's an indirect one.
That was Kenneth Austin. The Jews and the Reformation is out now, published by Yale University Press. And do visit historyextra.com for plenty more on the Reformation era. Thanks for listening. This podcast is produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow to hear Robert Coles on the history of sport in England.